You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode of Wake Up Hollywood. We're doing it via long distance, and I'm going to just jump in and welcome Mr. Corey Phillips. How are you, Corey?
I'm great, man. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too, man. Are you in Kansas?
I'm in Kansas right now, Lawrence, Kansas.
Dude, so, that's where the Wakarusa Festival used to be, right?
That's right. It used to be here right before I was, right when I moved out to L.A., they started it up on the outskirts of Lawrence. I think they did it a couple of years before they realized they needed something bigger.
That must have pissed you off. You move away, and then you're like, Oh, this big music festival.
Yeah, totally.
Right in my backyard.
Totally. But then I came back, and I demanded a slot, and then they were canceled then. So it's hilarious. So when I moved back here, they had just, had their issues and had to close the mountain and stop doing it for a few years. So that's where we're at now.
But you've been busy. You've been a busy man during the pandemic. You've been working on music, man. Tell me a little bit about you've been working on a new album and you've been just getting it all together. Tell me about the whole process.
Yeah, done with the new album. But yeah, during the pandemic, I think like everybody were kind of waiting to see where the flow was going or what we were going to be busy with, you know? And then, you know, we started, you know, sort of thinking outside of the box with live streaming. And when that, showed its limitations, I think everybody kind of reared back a little bit. And it just, the time was right for me to invest in my home studio. I've been meaning to do so forever and put my efforts to work. But I wanted things to go a lot faster. So we outfitted the studio and built an isolation room and wires and cords everywhere. I brought in a wizard engineer named Rob Rebeck, and he was commuting from Kansas City. And we recorded the whole album in my house, 14 songs.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many days of tracking did you guys do?
We started just before Thanksgiving, and we were doing maybe, as a band, we did probably 4 days of tracking. And then we started breaking it up into different instruments and stuff, and then doing overdubs and playing along with ourselves and things like that.
And how do you do it? Do you usually do like two or three takes and then kind of comp between takes, or do you do
the goal in the case, first? I mean, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You know, for the listeners, you know, you can go in and have the entire band in one room, all like outfitted with microphones and separations and things like this, so that you can record as like a live show sort of thing, which a lot of bands might be used to. Or you can go in sort of and, you know, engineer it and produce it a little bit, where you start with one track and you build from there, start with percussion and build from there. But what we wanted to do was a combination of both. So we put drums in the isolation room, and we all did our possibly throwaway tracks in the living room, like wires going completely opposite side of the house, keyboards, bass, and myself on guitar. And we were basically trying to get at least the best drums we could get, you know? So we're talking like 5-10 takes running through songs. It's like, how did you feel on that? It's like, well, let's listen back, scrutinize. Well, we'll save these three. And how did you feel on the bass? And then Mario on the bass would have to decide if it's something he wanted to work with and like then tweak and correct, or if he wanted to punch in and do things or what. But basically we were getting our drum tracks, and then we were lucky to get a lot of bass and keyboard tracks along with those drum tracks. So the layering wasn't as difficult afterwards.
And did you guys do it to a click?
Yep. For the most part, there's some songs that undulate quite a bit. I mean, you know, a lot of the music on this album is unapologetically disco and funk. So you got to have that four on the floor, that sort of that cursive pulse, things pushing it. But there's other songs on the album that definitely needed to undulate, move, and, you know, some time signature differences.
You know, I've never not recorded to a click.
Yeah.
I've done everything to a click. It's just like how I've always just kind of thought we need to always do this. There was one session I did where we did it without a click, and it was such a mess to try and comp with overdubs and stuff. I'm never doing it like this again. That record never saw the day, the light of day. And we just basically moved on and started over, you know, because I've just found that like having the click gives kind of everybody some kind of barometer of like, okay, here's where the beat is. Here's where we can comp if we need to edit stuff. But man, I find it so awesome when bands are like, yeah, we didn't use a click. I'm like, dude, that's like Led Zeppelin didn't use a click. You know, it's like, there's so many great bands. Jimi Hendrix, I don't think, used a click, you know? It's like,
isn't it? It seems that it should be like, I mean, you're doing the recording. It should be, you know, par for the course. It should be necessary. But there's certain situations where I've found it steals from something or makes something too boxy, stiff. Too stiff, too boxy, and it needs to sort of like rear back and like and move and as an acoustic songwriter, I'm sorry, as an acoustic guitar player, we kind of have that in our performance naturally, where we kind of like can be rhythmic in our strums enough to kind of change the pocket a little bit, and that allows you to be a little bit even more emotional on the record, I think. But it depends on the song. I mean, if it's the case you're not using a click, then the entire band has to really be connected on it, you know.
Yeah.
And so the ones, I think maybe one of the ones that I'd like to show you guys later is one that we didn't use a click on that has a lot of like just undulation to it. That's the best way I can put it.
But we did some things where, like, you know, there were weird time breaks, like time signature breaks. We're doing like halftime shuffles or like changing the meter completely, and doing that without a click would have been a mess. It was a mess with the click. Having to time, like we had to time the click, and we did everything on analog tape. So it's like we had to time the click like old school to make sure that all the breaks, it wasn't like editing in Pro Tools where you can just like move things around. You had to do the whole song with the click in it from start to finish. So every song we had to get the click, you know, just playing through to make sure it was in time. It was such a headache, but man, there's something that it does have an organic thing about it when it does have this click that everybody's kind of using, and then everybody's dancing around it in a different way because everybody's time is just different. You know what I mean?
And you can really feel that too, especially if it's funky or if it's in our case the disco stuff or the more four on the floor stuff. Because the bass can play around that driving beat, and man, I forget that you've done most of your stuff on analog tape.
So. I've done the last three or four records on analog tape, but I've done digital plenty, and I love digital, and I work on digital from home. But when I make a band record, I've found that digital, I find the way you find a click to be sometimes stifling, I find digital compression to be very stifling. Just like, so I let things go in the red on this record, and it ended up making for a better record. You know, it was crazy. Like things I never would have done when I started out. I did all of those things. And I found that, you know, the process, you know, this is what I wanted to ask you too. You know, when you're making this record, first I want to ask you what made you want to do a disco record? That's my first question. And the second question is, do you find when you're making records, you're trying to musically challenge yourself on every record, or maybe just this record? Did you find yourself challenging yourself to do something that maybe you weren't so sure about?
This collection of songs kind of were built around the idea of sort of party music and then like the bedroom after hours, you know? So they're sort of, you know, my favorite music was already in mind when the songs were being compiled, you know. A lot of these songs were, you know, they took a lot of the last 10 years since my last album to get to a point where they were my favorite things to perform. And so these are the ones I wanted to get out in this sort of motif of like a party album that retires to the bedroom. So it was going to be part disco and part R&B and soulful and some tongue-in-cheek, some sass and some attitude. But there's only so much that you can get away with when you're, let me put it a different way. When you're performing things live, you know, you have limitations to what you can pull off, whereas you have track after track, you know, recording digitally. And so there was this compulsion there to see how far I could go with a lot of these attitudes and these vibes. But ultimately I had to kind of restrain that and sort of have some allegiance to just where the songs had been being performed, you know, in a live setting with my 7-piece band. So yeah, there were some times we were trying to push the envelope, you know, like with a synth or with added harmonies, or like, well, maybe this needs a fourth round of, like, we have these, what I call boogies in the song Right All Night For You from the album, where like there's like three or four vocals boogieing on one lyric idea. And then a motif from earlier in the song comes in and does this counter sort of motif. I call it a counter boogie. And then there's a third boogie that we throw in there, and they're all rolling over each other. And it's like, is this too much, or is this exactly? Is this the medium that's allowing us to be able to do this to perfection, or is the medium allowing us to go too far?
So what you're saying is you blamed it on the boogie.
Exactly, you got to blame it on the boogie. It was too good to leave out. That's what ultimately you tell yourself. It's like, is it too good to leave out, or can it stand on its own? So yeah, there were some envelope pushings in these regards. But the disco stuff, it's some of my favorite music, you know, late 70s, early 80s R&B. I fell in love with it. I mean, it might be a niche to some people, but after, you know, falling in love with, you know, 70s R&B, I just got in there, and that just party music of like late 70s, early 80s, I just fell in love with, you know. A lot of stuff you hear from a lot of new artists, I think. Like Bruno and
Weekend,
Grand Tones and stuff.
Yep. And how did you find that this record was challenging you musically, artistically, expression-wise, creatively?
Wow.
How'd I mess around, Corey? I asked the good questions.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what's different is that it's been so long since I think I kind of had a little bit of a fear of the studio. Like, some things were uncapturable that live I was nailing, you know, and doing so well on tours and performing live, that it was daunting to try to do these things in the studio. But yeah, it was a challenge to try to get the ideas very authentically done, mix the organic qualities of the music with something that's sort of modern at the same time. I'm kind of new to the technology of the studio, and it seems like over the last 5 years, things have just progressed so rapidly, you know, digital audio workstations and preamps, you know, are the only things I even barely know what to talk about in a studio. So having like just amazing people like Robert Rebeck and my other musicians, like be able to show me what is kind of commonplace and what experimentations are easy to do just to try. That was always a pretty cool experience. Doing it in my house was wild. I didn't accept any limitations to that, but of course the engineer did, and he let me know about them, you know, every moment of the way that, like, we're in a house. Don't forget. It's like, we're not in a house. This is a studio. We're doing this, and it's going to sound better because of it.
Did you have to do any, like, kind of, like, soundproofing or kind of, like, anything with isolation?
We definitely spent a lot of time and effort and money on kind of sound blanketing and baffling. We didn't do anything to the house itself that I can't leave, you know, that has to stay, you know, built into the walls or anything. But we did a lot of baffling. and carpeting and rugging and blanketing and things like that. But we found very easily that what we were working with and the sounds we were gifted with, almost miraculously, almost like it was meant to be some studio house, that after we got some of the major, you know, foundation tracks down, I could use, most of us could just use the isolation room for our overdubs. And even the lead guitar player and keyboard player, Mike Hamm and Nate Holt, they just set up in the room with the, and this is common today too, they set up with the engineer in the control room and you just wire it in, you know? It's, you know, there's certain instruments that you want the room for, you know, and that's like vocals, sensitive, you know?
What did you use for your vocal mic? Do you remember?
Let's see. Did we use the Sennheiser? No. We used the Behringer M30, I believe. We tried the, we used the Mojave. It's a really nice Mojave mic. That's what we used. We tried all sorts, and we had a few loners that were like, wow, this one's got to be the one. But then we tried it, and it left something to be desired, because the music on the track, the music on the album will vacillate between, like, something very old soul Otis kind of voice, Otis Redding type of a husky sound, to something very fluttery and Michael Jackson, you know, or very falsetto and Princey. And so we needed something that would kind of capture all of that. And in all of our ABs, all of our tests of the mics, the Mojave, I wish I knew exactly, maybe during one of the songs I'll laugh.
I'm like a half gearhead, half I want to just experiment with any piece of gear to see what works.
Yeah.
But there's certain things that I've seen certain mics work better than others, certain rooms work better than others for a different reason. I think it's commendable that you had to learn the acoustics of your house and make a record at the same time.
On the spot we were doing it.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy to me, because there are enough variables going into a studio that's already has those things done that can come up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and Rob kept letting me know that. And so we'll probably, I mean, this might have been a one-off thing doing it in the house. I like the idea of it. I think it's just
if you basically build into making the house, that's what it's used for.
Permanently wire it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or, you know, you just have a vibe where it's like, you know what to do in your room. Like, I record everything but drums in this room, and I know what certain things to do and what certain things not to, but that's in here. Like, I do a lot of stuff in the box that I can use plugins to make it sound analog or you know, a pedal or whatever. But in the studio, I find it to be, man, the one thing that you probably had the luxury of that I found cumbersome was just taking all my gear to the studio. I mean, I took this amp right here. Hello.
And then
I took a bunch of pedal boards. I took like three or four pedal boards. And then I took like four or five different guitars. It was just like, this is crazy. This is too much. But
you have a lot of
I used every single one, you know, on a different song. And I knew I kind of mapped out what I wanted to do. But you probably had all that stuff. Did you kind of know what you were going to play on each song? Or was it kind of...
Yeah, you know, there's one experience I've never had in the studio. And, you know, you hear about it with... You know, your favorite acts, where they go into the studio with nothing written, or maybe a few things written, and they see what to do. You know, they use everything modern to create something. You know, it's like all the toys. But I've never had that. It's always been like things that I've road tested. You know, songs I've written, taught to the band or developed with the band, and then, you know, played at least. I mean, the least live played song on this album is probably played about 5 times. So, and that's not very much considering how often I played some of the other ones. But
isn't it crazy, like, how some artists do that though?
Yeah,
they go in with no material, just like, okay, let's see what we can come up with, And then they're in there for like 6 months riding. And I'm like, I've never had that experience where I'm like,
well, that loves you necessarily, but
yeah. If I'm 6 months into a record, we're already mixing and we're done with overdubs and we're heading to production of mastering or.
I suppose that's the ideal with having a home studio is that you're doing things on your terms and you don't have to pay by the hour to go perform your music really fast and get it recorded. You can indulge and everything, but I've never had that either. And so I've never really created music on the fly in the studio. So things have never been overproduced on one hand, and they've never been too far out of my manipulations also, you know, like if you have 5-6 guys hanging around the studio, everybody's lending towards each other's, you know, lending towards the jam or the creation. And as a solo artist, I always come up with the music, you know, on the edge of my bed or in my living room or wherever I'm playing guitar.
Well, let's play something. What do you want to play first?
Yeah. Well, there's a song that we've released. It's our first single. It's already on Spotify. And we have a little video on YouTube. Not a feature video, but it's on YouTube as well. It's called Fit You. And it's a radio edit of the actual longer jam that's on the record. There's a lot of longer jams on this record because, of course, it's a party album. But it gives you a quick idea how we compounded both the organic origin and direction of the song with a lot of the toys we're playing with. And you can get an idea of the slick production, too, and how the house sounds. Want to try it?
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it. This is Fit You, Corey. Yeah.
Burn a candle in the dawn, locked up in your bedroom, putting bullets in your heart.
Yeah, man. Very funky. Funky, funky. Really good sounds. I mean, you would never... Honestly, I love that, you know, home studios are a thing, because I love when you hear somebody records a record in their home, because it's like, you listen, it's like, you can't tell. That sounds great.
I mean, you still want it to be perfect, you know, so we pulled out every stop we could. Don't get me wrong. That was maybe the only difference, you know, or the only slouch, you know, really.
And Jamiroquai, I hear a lot of Jamiroquai influence on this record.
On that one already, huh? That one's that one always reminds me a little of like Sade or Michael Jackson or something. But yeah, I love Jamiroquai. A lot of their old stuff was very influential on me, and of course, everything that they do is influenced by, you know, old Stevie and Michael and Chic and Sergio Mendez and, you know, all those old disco classics, you know. So, in a roundabout way, maybe we're—I don't know.
You're channeling it.
We're plotting the same musicians, I guess, and the same influences.
And did you kind of like change a little bit of the styles, or did like the band want to kind of go in different directions, or were you like, "This needs to be a disco record. Let's get involved." No,
this is my record. You know, I have a great band. And I wanted to feature them and showcase them on the album. But yeah, I mean, it's my brainchild, you know, and I'd had decisions made about it for quite some time. When you do get your homies into the studio to start recording, there's always, everybody has, you know, they have their own right to their own flavors that they want to evoke, you know, in themselves. They're putting their own mark on record, you know. They're sort of putting themselves in the time capsule. So you want to capture that spirit of theirs. At the same time, you want to achieve your production, you know. So I had to wear a couple of different hats, you know.
I always find there's something... You know, on one hand, I'm always envious of my drummer, any drummer I've done a record with, because they're only in the first day, maybe the second day. And that's it. They're gone. And like 9 months later, a record appears on their doorstep. And I'm like, man, I'm envious of that, because you just get to be surprised by what's on the record. And you don't go through any of the obstacles of every record I've ever done. There have been crazy obstacles, whether it's... For us this time, it was the pandemic. Our last session was the day everything shut down. So that was our last tracking session.
Wow.
And then I had to make sure I was, I got COVID tested, because my engineer is 78 years old. So I had to make sure that I was COVID free. And, you know,
you were fortunate that the pandemic started right after you finished, because you didn't know you were going to be done necessarily, did you?
I think there were a couple more sessions planned, but we had everything we needed, you know, and it was like everything fell into place the way it needed to be. But I found that it was like, oh my God, not only is making a record tough, but now I got to deal with a pandemic. Like, that's a whole different obstacle, you know. And we were dealing with all the like the race riots, you know, with all the George Floyd stuff, like.
Yeah.
It was intense, man. The day we started mixing was when all that stuff was going on. And I'm like, man, making a record is just an arduous process that is very undervalued in society. And until somebody actually goes through the process, they don't really know what it takes to make a record. Yeah. And I salute anybody that does it. And especially now, because it is a labor of love more than anything.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, we were discussing things, you know, while I was in the middle of the project, you know, I was, contacting you, and I was like, hey, what do you think I should do about this? And what about this? Now, I think we were in the mixing process then, but even after that was said and done, I went to Costa Rica for 2 months to try to work from home elsewhere, which was awesome. I knew that the work I needed to do was all the album administrative stuff, all the administrative stuff, the clerical stuff, which is another side of it that's like, I know that you do you know, by yourself as well. And it's a full-time job. It's like being a label head and the secretary. And I mean, it's just, you're wearing every hat, you know?
I find it to be sometimes, like, there's joy when you see things kind of, like, happening. You know, like, yep. You know, now it's like we've been playing so many festivals over the years. Now it's, like, so easy to negotiate, so easy to get the contracts out. Everything's done. And it's like, okay, cool. Now we just wait for the performance or rehearse the band, get set list. But it's like, I find that, you know, a lot of people don't realize how much work goes into the entire process. When yeah. you are fronting a band, you're doing all the graphic, you're approving all the artwork, you're making sure all the notes inside the, you know, the liner notes are all dialed in. Mm-hmm. You're making sure all the, you know, logistics of the record are on all the platforms and doing all of that.
Then all of the registration titles.
It's like I'm envious of side musicians in a way, but then when you get that record mm-hmm. and you first see it all done, there's nothing, you get that high before anybody else does. You know what I mean? It's like, and I love that. It's like, man, you see all your work, all the blood, sweat, and tears. The fact that it's finished, man, that's the win right there. It's like
I feel bad for my drummer Chell. He was, you know, chomping at the bit and salivating, coming to all the overdub sessions after he was done, just to love it, just to celebrate it. And but it's just like, well, sorry, you're done, right? So I mean, I felt bad for him. But yeah, you know, you got your vinyl in. I'm still waiting on mine. It's been
It takes a lot. It takes longer than the CDs.
Sure. But and apparently, for those of you guys listening, there's been a resurgence in vinyl pressing around the nation, around the world. So what's good for vinyl lovers is that there's a ton of vinyl coming your way. But for those of you who are trying to release vinyl, it means that the production times are about twice as long as they have been over the last few years. So, like, I think our street date is August 20th on the vinyl.
Wow. And,
but you got yours, huh?
Yeah, man, I was so excited when they came. It was, I had to go, I picked them up, like, on a pallet. Like I got them shipped so that they wouldn't get ruined or anything. So I went to, like, Podunk area to get, like, you know, pallets of these records, but it was amazing to see it. And it's like, oh my God, it's here. It's finally, that's an experience. It's always an experience. And, you know, I'm sure you know this because you've gone through it already with CDs, but seeing your stuff on vinyl, it's even.
Yeah, crazy. Man. So this is my first one that's going to be on vinyl. And
Me too. It was my first one.
I think it's, you know, it's the right one for it. You know, my last one, too, probably wouldn't have held up on vinyl because of, I don't know. This one's just perfect. So, like, you know, we put a lot of time and effort into it. I'm a better producer and performer now, so I know it's going to be, you know, documented well. It's beautiful, 180 gram double vinyl album. And
you did your last record about 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, and I did that, like, hodgepodge, borrowed time. I'd, like, wait tables by day and then go spend my $80 to $100 that I'd earned at some dude's studio in the Valley or in Long Beach and just trying to, like, get these, what I thought were demos, and then halfway through, I'm like, wait a second, I can afford more than the demos, so let's try to muscle an album out of this. But it was still, like, 16 songs of, like, a very different genres and song styles and actually a lot of it came from different studios too, so it wasn't very cohesive, you know, like this album is definitely cohesive, like from start to finish it feels like it's one entity, you know.
Yeah. And from start to finish, how long did it take?
I would say so if we started it like on a whim somewhere in like mid-November, I mean, granted, the the outfitting of the house for the sound fitting probably took about a month before. But from recording, first setting up November to probably like the end of January, we were done with that, and then the mixing was done over February, and by my engineer Rob Rebeck in February, and then it didn't take much. You know, he was a whiz. Like, I think maybe like two back and forths, and maybe I sat on the third one and said that's it, or maybe a little tweak on the third mix, but it was done. He just like, it was amazing how it just like came together so quickly. And then Bernie Grumman mastered it in over March.
He's the man, dude. He's the man.
When I was in Costa Rica doing all the stuff, getting the album artwork done and everything, and all the administrative stuff. So it was finished right before I got back. So yeah, in April. So I'd say 4 or 5 months. 5 months.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fast. I think that's very fast. It usually takes me 8 to 10 months to finish a record. And then you have all the artwork to approve. Then you have all the other stuff. By the time it's in my hands, it's usually a year. It's like, and that's what happened this time. It's like, we finished 8 months, but I didn't have the CDs in my hands until January or December. And yeah, it was literally 12 months.
You may have had the same feeling. Like, I remember, was it probably February or March? We're brainstorming, you know, smoking cigarettes in the garage while somebody's doing their solos or something. And we're like, is it too early to release an album? Is it like, I mean, what we're thinking is like, basically in spring, we still didn't really know what the outlook was. You know, we knew that there was vaccines coming and numbers are dropping and blah, blah, blah. But I don't think it was until early May when anybody really felt that change. So it was a lot of guessing. And I think between the industry, the artists and, you know, bookers and venues, there's a lot of guessing going on and a late start to thing. But we were sitting on something, you know, or you're like, do I put this out now and wait to tour it? Or do I sit on it and like wait a little bit until there's a proper time until, you know, we've built all our momentum.
It's there's a neuroses that comes with it because you're like, I finally finished this work and now it'll only have a shelf life of 6 months because of the date. So we were going to release it in September of 2020. And then the guy that does my CDs, who's a really good friend, he was like, excuse me. He was like, yo, why don't you just wait till January? And I was like, oh my God, wait another 4 months to release this. And he's like, right. He's like, you'll have your vinyls, you'll have your CDs, everything will be finished. You can figure out what to do for a CD release if there are live shows, and there probably won't be. So it was like this whole thing. I was like, okay, well, all right, let's release it end of January, and then we'll have everything done, all the ducks in a row. We'll have the full year to promote it. But right. even when you have a record out, and I'm sure you're going through this now, it's like you get press, you know, you get some radio, you get some interviews, you do this kind of stuff, and then there's like, okay, we have to play this record out. Like, there's no substitution for that. No. So, like, the funny thing is we released the record in January. Our first gig, we're opening for ZZ Top, and we're playing a bunch of songs from the record for the first time. So, like, this record is almost going to be 2 years old by the time we play it.
That's what, when anybody told me, oh, maybe you should wait longer, I'm like, no, I'm going to be sick of this music. You know, it's like, you have to listen to it 1,000 times while you're doing it. You know, this should be a proper, it should be bursting out of your seams, you know, as soon as the record's done and then it's there, then you get sick of it. But to have to generate, that's never been my strong suit, you know, patience and pause and waiting for things to steam to develop. But, yeah, you having to. When is the show with ZZ Top and where?
That's September 11th in Milwaukee.
Holy shit!
Man, I can't wait because it's like literally the first time I'm gonna play a show in about 2 years. No, it's like I don't even remember my last gig. That's what's so crazy. It's like I have to look back and see what it was because I just don't remember what it was, you know? So, you know, it's a little, it's crazy. What I respect about what you did during a very dark time in the world's lifetime, you made something beautiful and funky.
That's right, man.
And like, that's the one thing that a lot of musicians don't really get that credit for. It's like, I don't know one musician who wasn't practicing or writing during the pandemic.
Up in their game, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like every artist was like still working on their craft, and that's what I respect. Let's play something else. What are we going to play next?
You can do, let's see. Give and the Take.
Give and the Take.
Split apart in the room.
Very nice, man. Very nice.
With classic rock sort of slow fade out.
I heard that, and I got a lot of it sounds like Steely Dan Dirty Work meets Jamiroquai. Again, you got this slow jam Jamiroquai thing, man, like on travel, man. These are my favorite artists. Like they're just an incredible band.
You know? I love hearing all these different things people say. Sounds like that I would never have thought of, and you know somehow creep through somehow. Yeah, I mean, I hear the Jamiroquai. I think my goal with that one, I set out to write like a live, like having sex in real time, you know, like kind of D'Angelo.
I don't say this about a lot of songwriters, but I love and respect the way you went about this whole thing, from the songs to the process to what it sounds like at the end. You know, you can tell there's attention to details. You can tell there's heart, and that's what I listen for more than anything. It's like, is there passion and heart in the music first? And then is there attention to details and dynamics? And when there are, it's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to just, you know, get comfortable and listen, because then it's like, okay, I can get into this. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a listening album and have like detail and nuance and a lot of the musicianship that these all-star players were bringing to the music. I wanted all that there. And I felt like I could afford those indulgences by like delivering, you know, a lot of like straight to the point, very pop melodies and song craft, you know, to much of the album. And then like having my way with sort of the end of songs, you know, where you take it a different direction. A Fit You is one of those. This is another one where it kind of goes in different places after a while.
And tell me about the title of the album, Sexy Thirst.
Sex Thirsty, Love Hunger. I imagined, that I was thinking, well, there's a dichotomy to the music here. Like some songs and some elements of the songs are very intellectual and sort of intellectual love and, you know, mindful sensuality, and others are very lascivious. Other aspects of it is very lusty and lascivious and party oriented. And I remember, I think it was Billy Idol's Vital Idol album when I was, it was like 87 or 88 when I was a kid. And it was back when, you know, cassette tapes, you had side A and side B, and side A sounded very much like getting ready to go out, you know, and side B seemed like coming back home after the party, you know, maybe with some friends and in a different mood altogether. But it was more intimate and more sensual coming back home. And I always had that in the back of my mind. It's like just the dichotomies of things. So I was thinking with an album of this size with 14 songs that I would choose them based on or situate them based on how they fit into that dichotomy. You know, so some are very, but then that's also a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek too, and kind of a trick, because some of them are both party sexual music, but I challenge people to hear those songs with a sort of intellectual sort of sensuality too, you know, and vice versa with the other ones that are a little more mental or a little more heady. So I was just had that in mind, and I think forever I had those two aspects of the songs in mind for like a party album that also had some slow jams on it.
Slow jams, man. They're a part of our upbringing, dude. You know, a slow jam it's everything, dude. It just changes the mood of a whole vibe and party. So I love that you did this kind of dichotomy of sounds, but all relating to the same thing, like a good time. It's a good time record. You know? Yeah.
And I hope people get that out of it too. You know,
they're gonna get that. There's no question. How could you not? You listen to it, it's funky as shit, you know?
Yep. Now we're trying to get it out there. That first single, Fit You, dropped in May, and we're dropping a new one. I'm not going to say which or whether we've heard it or not yet, or tonight, but it's going to drop, I think, before the end of the month. And when I say that, like the streaming platforms where I'm sending singles, kind of like you did, you know, you had a methodology that I really appreciated, but a lot of people are doing that where they're, you know, withholding the album until they built up, momentum with the singles and stuff like that. So.
Well, for us, it was the first time I was actually telling some friends this, you know, it's the first time I've actually released a record where we didn't do a CD release party. And so that was a bummer because I was like, oh man, we didn't do a CD release party. I did a live solo piano video, but this is what was cool about it. So I released the record on the day of the record, you know, on January 29th.
Yeah.
And I had planned for the release of the live performances to be at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So it was like 8 p.m. East Coast, you know. But it was the first time I ever released a record where everybody heard the record before the performance. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I love that. Because people were texting me during the record and saying, oh my God, I love this song. I can't wait. Are you doing this in your set? And I'm like, I can't tell you, you know. So it was like this all day thing where people were listening to the record and then the live performance. So it was the first time I've actually done a record. It really felt like
you really have a gauge of like, of what the album's doing, you know, right there in real time, instead of waiting for the shockwave to hit.
Yes. Yeah. Know. So it was actually something that was a pleasant surprise, you know, in the way we released it. Let's play something else. Cause I want to make sure we get all the tunes. What's the last tune we're going to play?
This last one is called, I think is it Come Get It On? Is that what we gave you?
Sounds perfect to me, dude. Come Get It On. Let's do it. Yep.
Sure.
slamming, dude.
Yeah, man.
You're going to be surprised by this. I'm going to say very Al Green.
Oh, yeah.
Very Lenny Kravitz.
Okay. I get that.
And very Bee Gees.
Woo! I love it.
Good mix of all three of them. Man, Corey, where can people find this record?
Well, you can find it at my website, CoreyPhillipsMusic.com.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
CoryPhillips, like my name's written here, music.com. Or you can find it on iTunes and Amazon. And you can you know, buy the tracks or download tracks or the CD. Like I said, you can pre-order the record. The vinyl is hitting the streets on August 20th. You can check out singles on Spotify and other streaming platforms. So you can find it anywhere. Just check out Corey Phillips and the Band of Light for this issue. And you can check out a lot of my other stuff on the website, too, that we've released as Corey Phillips in the past. So,
Corey, I hope you never stop. I hope you never stop making music, man.
I don't know how I would.
No, it is refreshing to hear the 70s soul, the funk, doing it the way it should be done. And, man, I respect the process, and I respect you as an artist, man.
Thank you, my brother. It's always good. It's always good to talk to you about this stuff and break it open.
Well, one more time, Corey Phillips. He's going to release this new record August 20th, Sex, Thirsty, Love, Hunger. Did I get it right?
That's right, man.
And check out his website, CoreyPhillipsMusic.com, for all live shows and for music on all platforms. Check it out. Listen to it more. How could you not want to listen to more of it? On behalf of Sam and myself and Corey, we'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Corey, for being a wonderful guest. And
thank you, Nicky.
We'll see you guys next week. Have a good night. And
listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nicky Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.